Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Our speaker tonight is Lee. It's hard to think of a part of Canando or an aspect of Canando that hasn't flourished under Lee's gentle touch. We have the grounds. She's long been the one keeping our beautiful grounds and trees and plants alive. She's been on the board and is now the president of Canando. And she's also an ordained member of the Abbot's Council. So it's a little bit hard to think of anything that Lee hasn't been involved in. Mm-hmm. But tonight she's going to add on to this from her copious spare time, a wonderful Dharma talk. So thank you, Lee.
Thank you for that excessively nice intro, Dave. So my talk tonight is called Preferences. The poem called Xin Xin Mei by the third patriarch in China, Master Seng San, whom we know in our tradition as Kanchi Sosan. This poem begins by declaring this one amazing statement. He says, if you want to understand the way, first, have no preferences. And for most of us, having no preference would be nearly impossible, perhaps even be a sign of being checked out of our own life. We see our preferences as being part of our personality and our uniqueness, but by holding on blindly to some of the ideas we think of as part of our personality, we sometimes may deprive ourselves of the opportunity to see life in a new way, in a new light. As a child, I didn't like waking up early in wintertime to get ready to walk to school in the dark, cold, often snowy weather. Later in grown-up life, I made every effort to arrange my work life so as to avoid early morning hours. I firmly considered myself as not a morning person. When I first became acquainted with Canando sometime in 2008, I believe it was, I was very interested in the practice, the teacher, the community, and I loved the feel of the place itself. But because I was firm in my old idea of I'm not a morning person, I only came to sit on Wednesday evenings and Saturday 9 a.m. sittings. I felt that sitting was very helpful to me. It was sort of part self-psychotherapy and part just opening up to the bigger picture of my life. Though I didn't understand the sutras and ceremonies, I just kind of allowed them the space to reveal their meaning when and if the time ever became right. My husband, Umar, had found Canando in 2007, shortly after the Rock Street Zendo had opened, and he attended 5:30 a.m. sittings and full sessions there. But I only came to the 9:30 Saturdays and to Wednesday evenings at first. I really loved Canando and embraced any ways I could join in and help as a Sangha member. And over time, the teaching and example of our teacher Les, and the Wednesday evening lectures, the community and activities of the Sangha combined to awaken in me an intention to just go deeper into the practice. Umar was attending Saturday all day sessions, which seemed really intimidating to me. He advised me to start by at first just coming to the afternoon work period and then the afternoon sittings. And I did that, and doing partial sessions like this eventually helped me to let go of my hesitation and sign up for a full day session. What I discovered when I did this is that sitting in our Zendo at 5:30 a.m. evoked a feeling of stillness and calm I hadn't experienced before. To my surprise, I also discovered that bowing and chanting eases some of the tightness of the body and mind. Even the at first daunting ceremonial Orioki style of eating meals made me aware of some of my habits and fears and helped me to slow down and pay attention. So not only was waking up early not the impossibly painful experience I'd imagined it would be, but all the activities of the day-long session just opened up in me a new awareness of the depth of Buddhist practice. Sitting together with other Sangha members, helping to serve meals, silently and mindfully cleaning the temple at work period, all helped me to let go of some of my ingrained ideas and open my heart to these aspects of our practice. So for Zen practitioners, this letting go is essential. It helps us to overcome a limited view of our capabilities. Sitting Zazen in the awareness of our connectedness to all beings is the heart of the practice. As we allow ourselves to let go of those preferences that may hold us back, we become able to engage more fully. Even for me, the ceremonies began to resonate more deeply. For me, the result of fuller engagement was a deeper connection. So just letting go, for me, of one old preference, this had the effect of opening and expanding my awareness, leading me to a clearer sense of the depth of the practice. I think we sometimes deprive ourselves of the opportunity to see ourselves in a new light by just holding on too tightly to fixed preferences and assumptions. So it can limit the concept of what we're capable of, and it can limit our lives. Sitting itself helps us to ease this tight grip of fixed concepts, ideas, delusions, and words. So on that topic, I just want to share with you three brief quotes from the Shin Shin Mei that kind of catch the spirit of it in a nutshell. The first one is, "Be still in the oneness of things, and dualism vanishes by itself." And number two is, "The more you think about it, the further you are from the truth," which is one I love. And the third one is, "Words, words, the way is beyond language. Words never could, cannot now, and never will describe the way." So I've now begun to look at my old reactions and responses to situations in my life, and always to ask myself the question, what other preferences might be holding me back? And I ask all of you to also consider, and please share, what preferences are holding you back? Thank you. Carolina, thank you. You're muted, Carolina. Okay.
So, your loveliness and beauty and gentleness, we see it again. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's so sweet of you. Thank you.
I don't lie. And one more thing. Could you repeat the three things that...
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
be still in the oneness of things, and dualism vanishes by itself.
Be still in the oneness?
Oneness of things.
Things, and dualism drops away.
Vanishes by itself.
And dualism vanishes by itself. Okay, the second one?
The more you think of it, the more you think about it, the further you are from the truth. I love that one.
The further you are from the truth.
No, the more you think about it, the further you are from the truth. I'll tell you what, Carolina, I'll just put them in the.
Well, that would be so nice.
Okay.
And who, and who said these things?
This was the master that we call Kanchi Sosan in our, when we do the names of the ancestors. He's also known as Master Seng San.
Is this the same thing as the way is not difficult for those who pick and choose? Is that the same thing? Okay.
Don't pick and choose. Yeah. There are many different translations of it.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Carolina. Any other comments or anybody else want to share some of their ideas? Can any of you think of, Diane? Yes, Diane.
Thank you, Lee. I'm wondering, like on Saturday mornings when we chant the sutras, if you have that same feeling of everyone chanting together, and there are words, there are words, words, words. I find that if I start thinking about the words, then the meaning totally vanishes. I feel sometimes, oh, yeah, that's right, I get it. And then my brain starts analyzing and thinking, and then the flow stops and the meaning is lost totally. And I'm wondering, have you experienced that even when we chant?
The thing about the chants was that, you know, at first they're so foreign to you. You don't know what's being really said. And I think the more you sit, the more you kind of get a feeling of what they're really reaching somehow to teach you something that can't just be put into words. You have to sit first and then chant. It's kind of funny that way.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the, you know, just the Heart Sutra, for example, you know, how many times have we said the Heart Sutra? And I remember, oh, dear Les, welcome back. It's so good to see you. I remember when I was first here and I heard the Heart Sutra and I said, could we have a class or something on what this means? And Les just said, no, just keep saying it. And you're so right, because somehow there's teaching in there that works its way into your heart, and you just you can't really explain it in words, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It has to just come to you. You can't
yeah. The meaning is not in the word.
Give it up.
Thank you.
Dave?
Well, just to follow up on that, in terms of, say, chanting the Heart Sutra, would it somehow overcome this problem with the words sabotaging it if you chanted in Japanese instead?
Well, because I don't know about you, because I don't understand the Japanese words, I just have to trust in what I know the Heart Sutra is, mm-hmm. You know, because we also do sing it in English. And so, I mean, then I just get, you know, kind of caught into the rhythm of it, you know, and the the sounds of the words are, you know, kind of shiki shokusei and, you know, stuff like that. It just has a kind of a meter to it. It's sort of like almost like doing rap or something to me. It has a, you know, cadence to it that's really kind of gets a feeling across.
Yeah, it's more like an instrumental piece of music and less like a song.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I actually had a question, Lee, about something that you said about which I thought really resonated, which was that the real problem is when you cling to these things and clutch them tightly. And I wonder to what extent, I mean, I've always thought that we use the term selflessness, and the real idea, of course, isn't to get rid of yourself, your small self. It's to not cling to it and to recognize it for its proper, rather smaller role in your life. And I wonder if the same isn't true of distinctions, discriminations, in the sense that the real damage that they can do is when we cling to them, like you said, it's when we hold on to them so tightly, and that, you know, that's what keeps us from recognizing, you know, that we see the differences so strongly that it masks the harmony of difference and equality. I just wonder if maybe holding them lightly in our hand sort of defangs all of these discriminations and keeps them from blocking our view of the bigger picture.
That would be a good thing. I just have found that it's a kind of, we're always taught, we're taught to have, you know, preferences, because that's what creates, you know, for most people, in most people's idea, a personality is that, you know, oh, well, I only eat this, I only do that, you know, it's just this kind of false image of who you are. You're really clinging to external things to try to define yourself. And even with your preferences, you know, as I say, sometimes you can just be afraid to go outside that little box that you've put yourself in. And when you do, all of a sudden you discover, you know, maybe there's an aspect to my personality that I haven't really yet expressed. And it gives you a sense of exhilaration that, you're not a fixed entity. You are, you know, part of the whole world, and you're being influenced by the whole world. And in turn, you're giving out influence to the whole world. So I really like that interplay.
Yes. Really.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Yes. Is that David?
Yes. Hi, Lee. Thank you for your wonderful, charming, and alluring talk about the Xinjing Ming. I have studied it with various groups about three times now, mm-hmm. and once was in the early part of this year. And for the great way is not difficult for one who is not attached to their preferences. That I came to feel that has a corollary in the often heard, be okay, accept things exactly as they are, with emphasis on exactly as they are. And while I struggled with this earlier this year, that the giving up your preferences is a cool intellectual idea, but accepting things exactly as they are proved to be very difficult and very painful. So that I set that study aside for a while. On a less heavy note, one of my favorite remembrances of my early years at Kanan Do had to do with the Heart Sutra. And I got all tangled up in the words. And I, after a while, I had learned it. And I would decline being given the chant card as the person walked around distributing the chant card, because I knew it. And I was very proud of myself for having learned the Heart Sutra. And then one day, down from Zen Center, they changed the translation And that completely derailed my false confidence in having learned this sutra. And to this day, I always wish they would put back the marvelous word Anattara Samyak Sambodhi instead of, what is it, that thing that's in that place, in unsurpassable perfect enlightenment. And I loved Anattara Samyak Sambodhi because it didn't have a meaning at the time. It was just a word, a magical word, and I still miss it. And I have not bothered to memorize the subsequent translations because about every 3 years they do another revision. So I just gave that whole thing up.
And I don't know if any of you have seen Kaz Ta-Nehisi's, I think he worked with Joan Halifax on a new translation of the Heart Sutra. Kind of emphasizes things a little differently. But sure. It's the same sutra, but we can kind of maybe find different ways to express a phrase, translate a phrase or something like that. It still has a magical effect though.
Thank you for your talk.
Thank you, David. Thanks for your input. Yes, Philip.
Thank you for your talk, Lee. Beautiful.
Thanks.
Talk. And I was trying to think of the ways in which preferences limit my life. And I just wanted to follow up with what Dave said. I've had trouble too with the new translation. I was sitting by myself for many years, and it seemed like about 10 years ago, I finally began to understand the Heart Sutra and was able to chant it in a way that it made sense to me and kind of encouraged my practice. And I've also had a hard time adjusting to this new translation, kind of preferring the rhythms of the old ones and the fact that I had it, it was part of my kind of brain structure. So it makes me think, makes me curious if I gave up that preference and just sat down and spent a few minutes, a couple of times a week and memorized the new one, what kind of, I might be dropping off things that, might be nice not to be carrying around. And I really appreciate your talk. And I just wanted to mention one of the things that resonated for me about what happens if you get rid of if you drop your preferences. Back in the 1960s, I dropped out of college, which meant that I was going to be drafted immediately almost, which I was. The Vietnam War just started. And going into basic training, it was a situation where I didn't have a lot of room for preferences. And one day I was walking around looking for a broom for having to do something, and it struck me that I was happy. I had imagined myself being in this really repressive environment, and it was not my lifestyle. And it really struck me that just walking, looking for a broom, that I felt was happy.
You knew what you had to do.
What's that?
You knew what you had to do. In any given time, somebody was telling you, oh, you have to go get a broom and sweep that. And in some ways, there's a little bit of comfort in that. Does that describe it?
But what you were saying, what I was taking from your talk was, that you get to know yourself, a different self. That you're carrying around your preferences, but you're also carrying around your personality.
Yeah.
And some of that is really nice to drop off. And maybe that's the same thing that you're saying, that the
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, it's what I was trying to emphasize there was, you know, we have ideas about ourselves, who I am. And a lot of the things that we attach to are really, you know, external things. You know? You might say, you know, I on Sundays, I like to, you know, go for, you know, for a walk in the park, or and somebody says to you, hey, this Sunday, you know, we're having a get together, you want to come and join us? And you say, no, on Sundays I always go for a walk in the park. I can't break that habit, you know. So I think it's maybe just holding things a little more loosely about who I am and what I do and what I don't do, and, you know, just kind of with things a little more consideration. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, Carolina.
Well, you know, a period of zazen, a sesshin, an entire Saturday morning, an entire practice period at Tassajara, your choices are limited. You're ending up like the army, you know. At Tassajara, you know, you get up when they say, you go to bed when they say, you work when they say, and you don't talk, and everybody eats the same. And you go to bed at the same time, you chant the same thing, and you don't go around having too many conversations. That puts you in a situation of no picking and choosing. You know, I was upset on the Thanksgiving Tassajara a long time ago. I only did one period of Tassajara, and I thought it was Thanksgiving, and we'd have all these different kinds of pies. Wouldn't you think? I mean, you're going to have to cook for all these people. I'd make, you know, pumpkin and apple and all the stuff that I like. But guess what? Pumpkin. That's it. Pumpkin for everybody. And I don't like pumpkin. That's it, you know. It's good discipline. And, you know, come on Saturday morning. It's a short retreat.
Exactly.
It's like, you don't get to do what you want to do. You know, maybe you can choose what food you want that's on, it's there, but it's nice. It's lovely.
Yeah, it's like a half day sitting.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We're very fortunate to have that. And we don't bring that up. You know, we stress work period, but it's all an integral thing.
It's all part of the, you know, it is like a sesshin schedule in that, yeah, in that respect. Thanks, Carolina.
You're welcome.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's kanndo.org.